Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, StubHub refunds and You Raise Me Up. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
As ever, we are going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music industry news stories of the last week. A week when CMU announced some online training to keep you busy on lockdown. What a scoop for the podcast that is.
Yeah, we announced something this week, which was the CMU lockdown webinars. So obviously we do lots of training courses here at CMU for people who work in the music industry. Sometimes online, although more often face-to-face at the London HQ of Lewis Silkin on Chancery Lane, although we have run quite a lot of webinars in recent times, and so now seemed like a good time to be offering some online training. We know that because actually quite a few people had already emailed us asking us if we were doing this. Yes, we are. So we've announced a series of lockdown webinars. These are going to be taking place on Tuesdays, Wednesdays and Thursdays from the 21st of April. There are currently 9 of them on sale. And these are going to be quite short, punchy webinars because it sort of feels like when everyone is locked down, yes, it's nice to connect with the real world. It's a good opportunity to do some learning and expand your knowledge of the music industry. But probably you don't want to be sitting there for hours on end, however good the learning may be. And of course, it goes without saying that our learning is very good, isn't it? I think we can say that. Can we say that?
I think that's the sort of thing you do when you're trying to promote something.
Well, let's say it then. I've said it. So, these are 50-minute webinars, each one focused on a different aspect of the music industry. And in those 50 minutes, we'll have about a 30-minute punchy presentation giving you all the key information you need to know about whatever the topic is. We'll then take some Q&A. So through the webinar system, you'll be able to ask questions. We'll answer as many of those as we can within the 50 minutes. We'll also put together a little FAQ after each webinar, which we'll then share with people who come to the session, where we give you written answers to the questions as well as what we deliver during the session itself. Plus, on top of that, we are also going to give you a very quick 5-minute explanation of whatever the biggest music business news story of the day is. So I guess that's like a little Setlist style summary, but we'll try and explain what you need to know in order to understand the big things that are happening in the music industry at the moment. So it's another way for everybody who's working from home, set up a home office in their kitchen or their bathroom.
Or their home office.
Some people have the luxury of a room in the house that was already a home office. Other people are having to use that little bit of the living room where the Wi-Fi connection is strong and there is a power socket quite nearby. So wherever it is that you have set up your home office, you can connect with the industry, with other people and with us through these webinars. So yeah, we've got 9 of them currently on sale. They kick off on the 21st of April.
Yes, so that first one is Making Money from Music Copyright. It'll be followed on the 22nd by Streaming Explained, the Digital Market in 2020. Then The Evolution of Record Deals, Music Rights Data Made Simple, Streaming Explained, How Digital Licensing Works, Music Marketing Toolkit and Tactics, Collective Licensing Explained, Get Played, Get Paid, Streaming Explained, How Money Gets Shared, and finally, The Evolution of Catalogue Marketing.
So yes, for each of those, we'll give you all the basic information you need. We'll answer your questions there and then. We'll also send you a written summary of the answers to those questions. Plus, we'll talk you through the key music business news story of the day. So why not join us? They are happening at 2:30 on each of the days. So that's London time. But as these are webinars, maybe you're elsewhere in Europe. So that would be 3:30 or possibly 4:30, depending on how far east in Europe you are. It's at 9:30 New York time. So if you're on the East Coast in the US, why not start your day with one of our webinars? So we've also made these as cheap as we possibly can. So we've slashed our usual prices. These are basically half price webinars. So it's £20, including VAT and booking fee, to get into one of them. But if you book into more than one, there are various discounts along the way. And if you are a premium CMU subscriber, then you get another 10% off. And if you're not a premium subscriber, then you should sign up for £5 a month on the website. And as well as the webinar discount, you'll also be able to access the whole load of CMU Trends guides. We're publishing a load of those at the moment because we've got a little bit of downtime. So there's a whole load of new CMU Trends guides going into the library, which you can buy from the CMU shop. But if you're a premium subscriber, £5 a month, you can access those for free and get a discount on the webinars. And I think that's probably what they would call in the podcast trade officially enough plugging.
Well, you should probably tell people where they can book tickets.
So if they go to cmuinsights.com/lockdownwebinars, or I am sure, I would almost guarantee this, Andy Malt will put a link in the notes that accompany this podcast.
Well, we'll see.
This is almost like we're a proper podcast with some sort of sponsor where they have to do the little bit of advertorial at the start.
Like those, yeah, except we're the sponsor.
Like those American podcasts who always seem to be sponsored by something really weird. So I don't know. The podcast is about... Oh, what was the podcast? Oh, sorry, I was watching a podcast the other day, which was about... It was a history podcast. And or was it a podcast or was it something on YouTube? Anyway, it was a historian doing a bit on what happened to all the dead bodies at the end of battles.
Right.
Which I thought was interesting. Well, yeah. What did they do? And so he explained how in different periods of history they did different things. But it was sponsored by a sort of shoot 'em up video game. I think.
Right.
One set in history, so there was a very loose connection. But it was sort of weird at the top and the end of this, you know, quite serious history podcast to then have him go and shoot up some bad guys on a video game. So maybe we could get a really inappropriate extra sponsor to this podcast where we have to give them some out-of-place advertorial at the start, and then we'll be a proper podcast at last. But first of all, we ought to do this edition of Setlist.
Yes, because this edition of the podcast is not actually going to be a discussion of potential advertising schemes. We're actually going to be discussing the dismissal of a song theft lawsuit over the song You Raise Me Up, made famous by Westlife and Josh Groban, although they are not involved in the case. But first, secondary ticketing website StubHub has been sued over changes to its refund policy as the COVID-19 crisis wreaks havoc on the live industry. Specifically, its insistence that some customers take a voucher to use on the website rather than actually having their money back when shows are cancelled.
Yeah, good news, everybody. If you thought this was going to be a COVID-19 free edition of Setlist, because the intro at the top of the show possibly implied that it would be, I'm sorry. One of the stories we're focusing in on is COVID-19 related. And we talked about last week, didn't we, on Setlist, how we had predicted that there would be a number of lawsuits coming out of the whole COVID-19 pandemic and the resulting shutdown of the live entertainment and other aspects of the music industry. But we didn't expect the lawsuits to come quite so quickly because we were foolish. We forgot that in America, if you're going to sue, you sue as quickly as you can. So last week we talked about the lawsuit against the talent agency Paradigm over the way it had responded to the live entertainment shutdown as a result of COVID-19 in terms of laying off a load of staff. This week, another COVID-19 related lawsuit. This time, a ticket buyer is suing the second ticketing website, StubHub, as you said, in relation to the change that has happened in their refunds policy since the live entertainment shutdown began, and whether or not those changes mean they are in breach of contract. But I suppose before we go into this particular case in any detail, we should acknowledge that since the live entertainment sector basically closed down almost overnight as those measures were introduced to restrict and delay the spread of COVID-19, the entire live industry, and therefore as part of that, the ticketing sector in particular, has been having to deal with an unprecedented challenge, which is everybody is set up for there to be an occasional event that gets cancelled, and then you have to process ticket refunds on that cancelled event. Nobody is set up for every event, every show, every tour, every concert, every festival, every conference to all cancel overnight. And so ticketing companies have had the unprecedented challenge of having to refund all of that ticket money.
Now, as part of that, there's been a big discussion about whether promoters are obliged to give a cash refund or they can offer credit or vouchers to use with the same company in the future. I mean, in many cases, if the show's postponed rather than cancelled, then you can just tell the ticket holders to hold on to their tickets and use them when the show actually happens. But if the show is cancelled and is definitely not going to happen, there is a big question over what exactly you're obliged to offer the people who bought tickets.
Yeah, and part of that will relate to what the terms and conditions were when the ticket was sold. But that said, in quite a lot of countries, consumer rights law will intervene. So in quite a lot of places, oblivious of what the terms and conditions say, the terms and conditions can say, if we cancel this event, screw you, you're not getting your money back. But in quite a lot of countries, consumer rights law will intervene and say, no, if an event is completely cancelled, then you are obliged to offer a cash refund. And in many countries, that obligation is actually on whoever sold the ticket, which is interesting for ticketing companies because obviously it's the ticketing company who has sold the ticket, but it is the promoter who has cancelled the show. But whatever the promoter does, the ticketing company, I say this is not true all over the world, but in lots of countries, the ticketing company will be obliged to issue a cash refund, which is one of the reasons why the ticketing companies are much more important in the live entertainment industry than I think most people realise. They're not just websites that sell tickets. They are also important cash flow providers for the people who are putting on shows and tours and festivals, particularly the bigger, more expensive shows and festivals and tours, which cost a lot of money to produce. And one of the challenges as a promoter is that a lot of your costs in putting on a show are up front. You incur all of those costs before the show has happened. But because in many countries, consumer rights law says if the show doesn't happen, whoever sold the ticket will be obliged to return that money, then on one level, ticketing companies should keep hold of the money. Ticketing companies should keep the money from the ticket sale in their bank account. So if the event doesn't happen, rather than handing that money over to the promoter, they can just immediately refund the customer. But for most promoters, if they can't get the money up front, as soon as the ticket is sold, they can't put on the show. So lots of ticketing companies take a financial risk by allowing the promoters to access that money ahead of the show. The risk for the ticketing company being if the show doesn't happen, the ticketing company will be obliged to refund the cash. It will then have to go and get the cash from the promoter. But what happens if it's a small independent promoter and the cancellation takes the promoter out of business? Or as what is probably happening with a lot of promoters at the moment, those promoters are busy filling out forms to go to their insurance company, desperately hoping that their insurance policy will cover them in this case, which it may or it may not, depending on exactly what insurance they took out, depending on how the insurer is choosing to interpret that policy. So that's the challenge that is going on. You're the ticketing company. In many countries, you are obliged to immediately issue a cash refund. Whether or not the promoter will be in a position to pass the money back to you, and that may well depend on what happens with their insurance claim. And so this is putting a huge cash flow strain on all the ticketing companies, primary and secondary. And there have been some predictions that it will put some ticketing companies out of business because you've got to have quite significant cash reserves to be able to be refunding so many tickets for so many cancelled shows while you are still waiting for promoters to hand that money over to you. And some of those promoters probably will never hand that money over to you because they're not insured and they may go out of business. So this has been a conversation across the entire ticketing sector. And in some countries where consumer rights law definitely says that there's an obligation on the ticketing company to offer a cash refund, there has been some lobbying going on to see if we can get a temporary change to the rules because of the COVID-19 pandemic that allows people to offer a credit rather than cash, and that the customer, if the customer wants a cash refund, they can't, as they usually would be able to, demand a cash refund under law. And actually, what you usually do as the customer in that scenario is you just go to your credit card company or your debit card company, because they are also in the chain. They are obliged to issue a refund, and then the credit card company goes to the ticketing company that goes to the promoter. So this is a conversation happening everywhere, but this lawsuit is specifically targeting StubHub, and I suppose in some ways the secondary ticketing companies are facing not only the same challenges as everyone else, but some extra challenges as well.
Yeah, because the secondary ticketing sites in particular have always made a really big deal about their money-back guarantees, which state that they will refund all your money spent on a ticket if you don't get into the show that you bought a ticket for. And there are two reasons for that. One is obviously the terms and conditions from the original sale of the ticket might state that the promoter can cancel that ticket if it's resold, and you might turn up and find that they are not going to let you into the show because they know that ticket's been resold and therefore they're cancelling it. The second is to combat fraud on these services, because as the secondary sites will always tell you, they're a marketplace for third parties, and someone could use those sites to list tickets that don't exist. And if that happens and you either don't receive a ticket or you receive a fake ticket and then turn up to the show and it doesn't get you in, you're guaranteed to get your money back in that case too. And the hope there is not only does that provide peace of mind for the buyers, but it also puts fraudsters off using the sites for those purposes. And it also then presents the secondary sites as a safer place to buy resold tickets than somewhere like Craigslist or Gumtree.
So yes, all of the second ticketing websites have always banged on a lot about their money-back guarantees for those two different reasons. For StubHub, the guarantee is referred to as the Fan Protect Guarantee. And that's what this lawsuit is about. This lawsuit has been filed, as you would expect, in the American courts by a ticket buyer called Matthew McMillan. And basically, he is taking issues with changes that StubHub have made to their fan protect guarantee as the COVID-19 live entertainment shutdown began, which he reckons is a breach of the contract that he had with the second ticketing website when he bought his ticket to a sporting event, which is now not happening. And in his lawsuit, he starts off by going through all the ways in which StubHub have bigged up their fan protect guarantee in the past on their website, through their marketing, through their partner websites. And then he basically goes on to present a number of allegations about how StubHub have changed their guarantee in recent weeks, the order in which that happened, and why he feels that what they have done is not allowed under their own terms and conditions.
Yeah, so as sporting, music and other live events started to get cancelled in March, as measures were introduced around the world to restrict and delay the spread of COVID-19, StubHub told its customers that instead of a refund, they could choose a voucher worth 120% of their original ticket purchase to use on the site at a later date. But then on the 25th of March, the company's position changed, so in some circumstances, customers would be forced to take the voucher rather than the cash.
Yes, so according to the lawsuit, that change on the 25th of March happened without any further correspondence going out to ticket buyers. And as a result, in the words of the lawsuit, the fan protect guarantee changed on StubHub's website so that it now stated if an event is cancelled and not rescheduled, you will get a refund or credit for use on a future purchase as determined in StubHub's sole discretion, albeit in brackets with the extra disclaimer unless a refund is required by law. Because obviously, as we've already said, StubHub can change its terms and conditions all it likes. In some countries, it won't matter because the customer can still rely on what consumer rights law says. But in the US, where this lawsuit has been filed, things like that vary from state to state because often what the law says about things like refunds, it's state law, not federal law. So therefore, in a chunk of America at least, StubHub is now saying whether or not you get a voucher or a cash refund or a choice between the two is now at its discretion.
In a subsequent email to customers on the 30th of March, StubHub president Sukhinder Singh Cassidy explained how his company's usual policy is to advance monies to sellers before an event has taken place, despite the usually modest risk that a refund may be necessary. And then if it is, StubHub then issues the refund before seeking to recoup the money from the seller. These practices, he said in the email, are a convenience for both buyers and sellers. But, the email goes on, given the impact of the coronavirus, it is not possible to sustain this practice in the near term.
Which brings us to the key claim in Macmillan's lawsuit. The lawsuit says in response to that email from the 30th of March, these refunds, that being the refunds to the customer, these refunds were not offered as a convenience to buyers, but rather were a key component of the contract between StubHub and its buyers and the underlying feature of the heavily advertised fan protect guarantee. These refunds were not courtesies from StubHub. They were, in fact, and they remain, contractual obligations.
And to that end, Macmillan would like his money back. And he's also seeking class action status for his lawsuit so that if he was successful in forcing StubHub to provide his money back, it would also have to give any US customer who'd bought a ticket on the site before the 25th of March policy change their money back too.
So yeah, if this case proceeds and if it is successful, it will have quite a big impact on StubHub in those parts of the world where consumer rights law is not forcing cash refunds anyway. There's lots of speculation about StubHub and indeed most ticketing companies' ability to actually offer cash refunds across all of the tickets for all of the events that have been cancelled. As we record this podcast, StubHub, which of course is now ultimately owned by Viagogo, even though that merger hasn't properly happened yet because of some regulatory issues in the UK, but nevertheless, it is in essence now a Viagogo business. It, they, nobody on that side of the table have as yet responded to this lawsuit, but what I would expect, if and when they do respond, is there is a little technicality in Macmillan's specific circumstances that they could look to exploit to try and have this case thrown out of court. Even if, actually, the core arguments in that lawsuit, which is to say, you can't just change your terms and conditions with hindsight and remove a guarantee that was in place when somebody bought a ticket. The complication is that the ticket that Macmillan bought was for a National Hockey League game in the US. Now, the NHL, like many other sporting leagues around the world, have put their current seasons on hold. But crucially, as we record this podcast, this may well be about to change, but as we record this podcast, NHL haven't actually cancelled the season. They've just postponed it indefinitely. Now, it seems almost certain that that indefinite postponement will ultimately result in a cancellation, which will mean that the game this guy bought a ticket for won't happen, which means that he will therefore qualify for some sort of compensation, whether or not that's a voucher or a refund, and then all the other arguments in the lawsuit will kick in. But until that game is actually cancelled, StubHub could say, well, your circumstances are very specific. They are not the same circumstances as everyone else who needs a refund for a ticket for an actual cancelled event, so therefore we should either dismiss this case or certainly not give it class action status because it relates to a very specific circumstance. So that could be a nice big fat technicality that StubHub could look to exploit. But it does remain to be seen how they respond to this, how the courts respond to this. And it's interesting, isn't it? Because for a lot of people in the music industry for whom StubHub are kind of the enemy because they don't like secondary ticketing, they don't like ticket touting, they might be quite heartened to see the secondary ticketing companies facing issues around the COVID-19 shutdown. But we should stress that it is not just the secondary sites who are facing these challenges. It is not just the secondary sites who are proposing that maybe we should go for a voucher system rather than a refund system. These are challenges across the ticketing sector, which are being discussed and debated elsewhere in the world as well. But extra complications with the secondary sites because, as we've said, they've always bigged up their money-back guarantees in a much more prolific way. Plus, of course, there's extra people in the chain because if StubHub have to refund the money, they then have to get the money back off the tout, or the scalper in the US, I guess. The tout, the scalper, the broker then needs to get the money back from the primary ticketing company who is waiting for the promoter to find out whether or not they're insured. So StubHub is at the end of quite a complicated chain there. So it will be interesting to see if this case progresses and what impact it will have on StubHub and its new owner, Viagogo.
And finally this week, another US court has thrown out a song theft lawsuit, further suggesting that any precedents we thought might have been set by the good old Blurred Lines case are not, in fact, impacting on similar litigation. This time it's a lawsuit relating to the song You Raise Me Up, which was originally recorded by Secret Garden and then made more famous by covers of it by Josh Groban and Westlife in the mid-2000s. It was originally written by a Norwegian songwriter called Ralph Lovland, who was accused of ripping off a 1977 song called Soknerder, which I'm sure is the correct pronunciation.
Perfect Icelandic from Andy Malt there. I can almost feel that is certain.
Yes, because it was written by an Icelandic singer-songwriter called Johan Helgason. So it's a truly international legal battle, this one.
Although I suppose it would all be Nordic, wouldn't it? Norwegians versus Icelandics, if it hadn't been for the fact that the reason people know this song is because, well, in America, probably because of the Josh Groban version, and in the UK, because of the Westlife version. So yes, this Icelandic singer-songwriter accused this Norwegian songwriter, composer, musician of ripping off his earlier work when he wrote You Raise Me Up. The lawsuit was actually filed back in 2018, and at the time, it was reported, I think in the Icelandic press, that before they went legal, Helgason, the Icelandic writer of the original song, had sat down with Iceland's collecting society, which is STEF or STEF. They'd analysed the two works and they reckoned, it was reported at the time, that they were 97% alike.
I mean, that seems like a clear-cut case to me.
It certainly does. And so this is yet another plagiarism case, song theft case, going through the American courts where we have a new song that is accused of ripping off an earlier song and therefore of copyright infringement. And the reason why this case is interesting, as you said at the start of this section, is because obviously this is part of a bigger story, isn't it? In the wake of the Blurred Lines case, where Robin Thicke and Pharrell Williams were famously found liable for copyright infringement for lifting elements of the Marvin Gaye track Got to Give It Up. That was copyright infringement, said the jury in the Blurred Lines case. Lots of people in the music community, the songwriting community, were critical of that decision back then, saying that actually what Pharrell Williams, Robin Thicke had borrowed from the Marvin Gaye song were just common musical elements. Some people would say it was a vibe, and surely copyright isn't meant to protect common musical elements, which are used in lots of songs. It can't possibly be protecting a vibe. So plenty of people said it was the wrong ruling. We then had a flurry of similar cases going through the courts. But what is interesting is just in the last few months, with the Ninth Circuit ruling in the Led Zeppelin Stairway to Heaven case, with the overturning of the Katy Perry Dark Horse case, it does feel like lots of judges in American courts are trying to restrict the reach of the precedent that was arguably set in the Blurred Lines case. And I think we've seen that happen again in this You Raise Me Up case. And I suppose the reason why this case is particularly interesting in the context of the Blurred Lines litigation is that the Hegerson side, having reckoned themselves that the two songs were 97% similar, they then hired a musicologist, as you do, to try and get some academic rigour in your claim in court. But crucially, they hired the same musicologist as worked for the gay side in the Blurred Lines litigation, obviously very successful in that litigation. Her name is Judith Fennell. But in this case, the judge was very dismissive of the expert opinion she presented to court, in which she was backing up the original claim, which is to say that You Raise Me Up was very, very similar to this 1977 song written by Helgerson.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I think possibly on this very podcast before, we have been a little bit dismissive of musicologists because, I mean, they do always tend to come up with a report that very much agrees with whoever's paying them. And that was kind of what the judge was getting at in his judgment, I think, where he said, "The Fennell report fails to describe reliable principles and methodology, fails to apply such principles and methodology to the facts, and fails to apply the extrinsic test, rendering the reports unreliable, unhelpful, and inadmissible."
Yeah, he then picked holes in certain statements contained in Fennell's reports. So he said, "Fennell considers notes to be similar, even when they appear in different places in the song's melodies. Fennell offers no justification for this technique of considering notes to be similar despite different metric placements in the melody." He then said that Fennell opines, that's a good word, isn't it? Fennell opines that identical pitches found in succession in both songs are similarities, but then admits that there are intervening pitches between some of these notes. Again, there appears to be no justification for deeming notes to be consecutive when in fact there is an intervening note between them.
There aren't that many notes, are there? If you're going to say these songs are the same because they use some of the same notes, that is a bit of a stretch. You could say that about a lot of songs.
We're not saying that is what Fennell said. But what is certainly true to say is that the judge who had read, we haven't read her reports, so we're kind of mocking it secondhand. But the judge, we would assume, had. It would be bad form if he hadn't. And yeah, he was very critical of her methodology and basically saying that he didn't believe that, despite what she and the Icelandic Collecting Society had concluded, that these two songs were sufficiently similar to constitute copyright infringement. There was also what I am officially now branding the Danny Boy defence that had been presented by defendants in this case.
Yes, which was that common elements between the two songs can also be found in the public domain folk song Danny Boy and other earlier works. And acknowledging that argument, the judge concluded that when the Danny Boy similarities are excluded, You Raise Me Up and Socknerder aren't actually all that similar at all.
So needless to say, having dissed the expert musicologist opinion presented by the plaintiffs in this case and accepted the defendant's observation that actually the common elements of these two songs are common elements that they've both seemingly borrowed from earlier songs and therefore surely copyright can't be protecting those elements, the judge basically threw this case out of court. And as I say, although this is just one single case, really, we can see this alongside those other significant judgments that we've had in recent months, which seem to be responding to concerns in the songwriter community that the Blurred Lines judgment and any precedents which it may or may not have set is actually quite dangerous because lots of songs have common elements. There are, as you've already said, a finite number of notes, a finite number of rhythms. There are certain combinations of notes, certain techniques that songwriters and composers use because as human beings we respond well to them. Lots and lots of works use those, so surely those can't be protected by copyright, is what critics of the Blurred Lines judgment have often said. And it does feel like this year, most judges, it has to be said that these landmark decisions have all been judge decisions, not jury decisions. Whereas remember, Blurred Lines was a jury decision. The original ruling that was overturned in the Katy Perry Dark Horse case was a jury decision. So maybe we're sort of seeing a difference of opinion between where juries are presented with the evidence and where judges are. There is also an argument in complicated copyright cases, particularly cases like this, where copyright law isn't really very helpful. that actually putting it to a jury probably isn't that good an idea. Anyway, it certainly wouldn't happen over here, but it does in the US.
Yes, and there was a flurry of song theft lawsuits after the Blurred Lines ruling, many of which are still working their way through the courts. So we will see if the judgments in those cases further weaken the precedent set by the Blurred Lines judgment.
Yes, maybe some of those other cases will have significant developments in the weeks ahead, which will allow us to have a COVID-19 distraction in each edition of Setlist. It does sort of seem at the moment that the only big stories that warrant Setlist time, which are not COVID-19 related, because we want to have some stories that are not COVID-19 related, are messy lawsuits. Because as you've said a number of times on Setlist, it seems that the one group of people who are still very much working during the pandemic are the lawyers. But, you know, maybe next week we'll be able to find the non-COVID-19 story that isn't some messy lawsuit.
Well, the last week we had Public Enemy, didn't we? And that wasn't a lawsuit.
No.
Although it did involve a legal letter and it was a dispute.
And it was very messy.
Yes. But let's see if next week we can find something that is not any sort of dispute at all. I've laid down the gauntlet for us.
And not COVID-19 related. So see you in 7 days' time to see if we can meet that challenge.
Yes, because that is all we have time for on this edition of Setlist. You can subscribe on your podcast app of choice, probably the one you're listening to us on now, where you're already subscribed. I mean, why wouldn't you be? And you will find out if we've managed to find anything that is not dispute related. We'll see. You could also email us if you want on any subject you like. I mean, preferably something we've discussed here, but, you know, whatever. We are at setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by Andy Malt and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Setlist is an Unlimited production.